The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly, and I'm Anne Perkins. The economic crash of 2008 wiped out investors, sunk banks, and brought down with a bump governments across the Western world. But in the bookshops that survived the slump, one book was flying off the shelves. Das Kapital, The Capital, a work by the 19th century economist and philosopher Karl Marx. Even the centre-right president Nicolas Sarkozy was pictured with a copy before he was ejected from office by French voters. Marx's legacy is still contested by everyone from free market think tanks to university common rooms to those who've occupied city squares. For his advocates, not only did Marx foresee the current crisis, his philosophy provides the only way out of it. But for the author of a new biography, Jonathan Sperber, things are not so simple. And he joins me now from the University of Missouri. Jonathan, globalisation, rampant capitalism, unstable international finance. Isn't this very much the world that Marx anticipated?
Well, Marx certainly talked about globalisation, about global capitalism. But if we look more closely at the capitalism Marx analysed and the demise he predicted for it, we see not today's contemporary capitalism, but a 19th century version. And indeed a version of the early 19th century, of the early years of the early and difficult years of the Industrial Revolution in the UK, one which is not, although it has the same name as today's capitalism, is really rather a different animal. Marx's capitalism was a capitalism of individual entrepreneurs. He saw corporations as the sign of the triumph of socialism rather than as an advanced stage of capitalism. Marx's globalization was largely limited to Europe, North America, and perhaps Australia. He envisaged a communist future as one in which enlightened European socialists would bring countries like India up to a higher level. This is not today's capitalism. So a lot of these things were quite different. Marx envisaged the future of capitalism in terms of a declining rate of profit. I can't say I've noticed that capitalists have seen that in recent years. So I think a lot of these things are just moving in quite different directions. That's why I looked at Marx's analysis as being rather different from what we see today. In the 1860s, the early stages of capitalism in Russia at the time reminded him of England of 50 years previously. Capitalism in all its early infamies was, I believe, how he put it. And we can see some of these things going on in Bangladesh, for instance, or in China. Although I must be said under very different circumstances from the industrialization of Russia in the 19th century.
Are you surprised that people have turned to Marx over the last two or three years?
No, I'm not. What we saw from 2008 onwards was this system of a largely deregulated, increasingly globalized capitalism, which had developed over the previous 35 years, went into an enormous crisis. And it's not surprising that people would then look at Marx, who's, after all, we all know, is the theorist of capitalist crises, and try and assert the relevance of his ideas. What I guess I'd personally say about this is that Marx had some very interesting things to say about capitalist crises, not so much in his major economic writings like Das Kapital, but in his newspaper articles as a correspondent for the New York Tribune in the 1850s. But if you ask me, where should we best turn for a consideration of our contemporary prospect? I think we can learn a lot more from people like John Maynard Keynes or Hyman Minsky or Joe Stiglitz or Paul Krugman than we can from Karl Marx.
Can I ask you a couple of questions as a biographer? Because in some ways, that seems to be the really interesting thing about your book, that you write about him in his 19th century context. You don't set out to dismiss the idea that he's, or to advance the idea that he's not relevant to today, but you do want to say he is a man of the 19th century.
Yes, that's exactly right. And this, I think, relates to my attitude towards the 19th century, which I've been studying for the last 40 years. So I've gotten sort of familiar with that period. And what I can say about the 19th century is that sometimes it seems very close to us. Sometimes it's like the predecessor to the current day. There are these sort of flashes, these moments. In 1989, when revolutions raced through communist Europe, everybody thought about 1848. 2011 and the Arab Spring, there were similar perceptions. But most of the time, the 19th century seems increasingly distant to us, rather an alien I won't say it's like the Middle Ages or classical antiquity, but it's getting there as time goes on. And that's sort of how I look at Marx. Sometimes it's he's very familiar and seems like really he's got his finger on the pulse of contemporary world, but most of the time it seems like he's in this rather past epoch.
But the interesting thing about crises is that they often do seem to echo earlier crises, don't they? There are similar forces at work, even if they're manifested and they're kind of arranged differently.
Right, and I think that's certainly the case. And that's one of the nice things about studying the past is it can provide us with perspectives in which to consider the present. That's why, you know, I'm a historian. I believe there's a real value, intellectual value in what I do.
But 1989 and 1848, or indeed 2008 and 1848, or the Arab Spring and 1848, how far can those parallels be drawn?
Well, you know, they work to some extent and not to others. And I'm not somebody who believes that history repeats itself or anything like that. What I do think is that considering the parallels, they provide us with a way of thinking about the present. They provide some insights, some ways in which to analyze the present, some ideas that might be fruitful or maybe not.
One of the kind of interesting things that seems particularly apposite at the moment as we look at Egypt struggling to sustain any kind of semblance of democratic revolution is the significance of organisation, which is one of the interesting things that you draw out of Marx's life, his role as his not very successful role as an organiser. Is that a parallel that you'd be interested in drawing out?
Yeah, when I was asked about 2011, I said there's a lot of parallels. One of the reasons there's a lot of parallels to 1848 is you have a revolution in regimes that were previously very authoritarian, that did not have a free press and the institutions of civil society, any of those things. And the result of the revolutions, after the new revolutionary regime introduced democratic elections, was that the winners were often religious groups, who were the only kinds of organizations that had existed in the previous authoritarian regimes. And the actual revolutionaries sort of got shoved to one side. We've certainly seen that in the Arab Spring, although things seem to be changing in Egypt again, as I listened to the news this morning. But we can see some interesting parallels in that respect.
Do you think Marx's efforts to establish himself, or indeed to build an organization of working men, have any resonance today?
Well, I think the answer I'd give to that is that after Marx's death, this organization of working men became enormous. We had the mass political parties, trade unions, the cooperative movements of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and it expanded, well, throughout a lot of the world until the 1960s. Since then, we've seen things going in another direction. Marx's efforts were very, you know, they were honestly rather crude. It was very early stage in the development of the working class as a class and of economic and social organizations. We really, in this respect, we really live in a very different world today.
But the area where I'd argue that you might see a parallel is because he was about trying to establish an identity that can be converted into political currency. And that seems to me to be one of the things that particularly in the Middle East, remains to be done as some kind of alternative to a religious identity.
I think that's very true. Marx did do that. Of course, in his time, there were many, many competing versions of these sorts of identities, national identities in particular, one that Marx always regarded as rather trivial or petty, although it turned out not to be the case. And I think that's still true today.
I wonder if part of what you're saying is that there is a it's always very difficult. It's very interesting because this is a really kind of radical biography in the sense that you've gone right back to his original writings. You've done a lot of translation of your own. You kind of set out to rediscover Marx, to chisel off everything that's kind of accreted to him over the last 150 years. I wonder if perhaps biographies do tend to invariably stamp what is important to them in their time on a figure from their subject, and that what you're doing is really kind of almost a new form of biography.
I'm not the only person who's done that. There have been a number of biographies that have worked in a very similar direction. One example would be Ian Kershaw's biography of Adolf Hitler, which places Hitler very closely in the age of total war, which shaped him. Another example, which is a little bit more obscure, is the Dutch scholar Heiko Obermann, who wrote A Wonderful Life of Martin Luther, another great German intellectual. arguing that Luther's really not a modern figure, but a more backward-looking late medieval one. And that was sort of a model, at least for me, to how one could think about Marx.
But at the same time, what matters now is how we understand. Even if he didn't mean what he was saying in the way we understand it now when he wrote it, nonetheless, there is a truth about the way we see him now that is still significant.
I'd be the last to deny that. And I'll just push this analogy with Heiko Obermann's biography of Martin Luther a little further. Today, there are not a lot of people who are really concerned about issues like salvation through faith alone. My apologies to the Lutherans who still take this very seriously. But we do understand that Luther was a gigantic figure, one who perhaps unintentionally shaped much of the modern world. In a lot of ways, the same thing can be said of Marx.
And that's what great historical figures do, is that kernel of truth and the way that it's used and the way that it's exploited.
Oh, not necessarily a kernel of truth, or it might be something which people creatively misunderstand.
Yes.
And I would argue a lot of that about Marx is what's been going on here.
I like that thought very much, the creative misunderstanding. So if you were 21 and in Cairo now, would you say read Marx, or would you say think again, think more widely, find something more contemporary, more familiar?
That's a great question. And the reason it's a great question is my son is 21. So I think about that some. I would not advise him to like necessarily, I mean, he certainly can read Marx, but I think if he's interested in discussing the contemporary prospect, the problems of the crises, indeed, of today's world, he should be looking at some other issues. Issues of human interaction with the environment, for instance. He should be looking at some more up-to-date analyses of global capitalism. Those would be a couple of the things that I think might be more helpful than looking for directions in Marx.
They just, none of them feel quite so visceral, so directly speaking to what's kind of going off today. And maybe this is because, you know, I'm in Europe and you're in the United States, but what's going on in, you know, in Southern Europe as well as what's going on in the Middle East seems to us to be so chronically about the relationship between the working class, the working people, and the forces of capital, that Marx does become overwhelmingly significant.
I am, you know, there's actually a lot more of that perhaps going on in the United States than you might think. Often it's politically interpreted in rather odd ways in this country, but certainly since 2008, we've seen a lot of that here as well. I won't deny that, but I mean, what I'd say about that is often the case in Europe is it's if we see some of the arguments of contemporary economists, this has less to do with the claims of capital and more to do with rather perverse economic policies that aren't necessarily in the interests of capitalists either.
I am interested in the breadth of Marx's interests and the fact that his theorizing and his intellectual endeavor was very much a small part of a life that was preoccupied not only by organization and by journalism, but also by the sheer gritty day-to-day difficulty of surviving on not very much money.
That's very true. One of Marx's one-time friends and associates referred to him as the Aristotle of the 19th century. And I think that's really true. He was a man of enormously wide intellectual interests, sometimes maybe a little bit too wide for him to ever finish one project he took part in. He was also a political activist. He was a journalist, actually a very successful and sophisticated journalist. And he was, of course, as you point out, he was a husband and father, a family man, a 19th century bourgeois paterfamilias, trying to support a family under difficult circumstances. So he was that's one of the things I tried to do in the biography, is present a total picture of the individual, the many different facets of his life.
Do I understand you correctly that you feel that his personal circumstances actually radicalized his writing? Particularly after, we make this very interesting,
yes,
kind of translation. You know, we've got Marx of the early 1840s who was actually prepared to kind of defend sort of capitalism and liberal capitalism and bourgeois capitalism, and yet is arguing for communism only a few years later, and then seems to go back again.
No, that's certainly true, and that relates to the fact that, of course, he lost his job. The Prussian government closed down the newspaper he was editing. He went to exile in Paris. He hung out with a bunch of leftists and radicals there, with radicalized French artisans and German artisans living in Paris, and this moved his thought in a distinctly communist direction. So that's certainly true. many of Marx's classic ideas, like the idea that an economic crisis is a necessary precondition to revolution, appear in his personal circumstances, as a result of his personal circumstances. So I think that's true, what you said.
Marx, Wagner, they were a great crowd, the 19th century revolutionaries, weren't they? I wonder if there's ever been a generation, a period that produced so many fascinating and multifaceted thinkers.
I think that's very true. We can add lots of figures to that. Mazzini would be one that comes to mind immediately. But you're certainly right that, of course, the revolutions of 1848, the sort of matrix of the middle of the 19th century, were the most widespread revolutions in European history. They reached from the Atlantic to the Carpathians, from the Baltic to the Mediterranean. There's never been, although they were not very successful as far as revolutions go, they were the most widespread of all the major revolutions in European history from 1789 to 1989. So it's not surprising that we see a large number of people whose lives were profoundly affected by them.
Does that imply that you don't think, even though they feel very widespread at the moment, these revolutions and revolutionaries' fervors and popular demonstrations are still a long way from producing that kind of really fundamental upheaval that those two centuries produced?
Yeah, well, you know, the 21st century, we're seeing some of these things on a global scale in a way. 1848 was a very Eurocentric event, probably the most Eurocentric of all the major revolutions in European history. What we see today are these sorts of demonstrations that go from OWS to the Arab Spring, to demonstrations in Spain, to Brazil, to Turkey, increasingly hooked up not just by TV, but by the internet and Twitter feeds and Facebook. And so we are seeing a new phase of globalized social struggles going on. In some parts of the world, they have been revolutionary. In others, although they've been important in places like the United States or in Brazil, they don't quite seem to have quite the same brisance that they had in the Arab world. But of course, these are very different countries.
The curious thing, though, is that Marx was recognized as an intellectual leader in his lifetime. He, as you just said, you know, the Aristotle of the 19th century, he was recognized by his contemporaries as a huge figure. And there's no one out there now who could even begin to claim that kind of prominence and recognition, is there?
I would say the recognition you're talking about really developed with Marx after his death. He was well known, but in fairly narrow circles among German political activists. And it was only really with the Paris Commune of 1871 that he became a figure known across Europe and indeed in North America, in the Americas, sort of a global figure. And Marx is that, you know, the iconic Marx, the dude with the big beard, is really a figure who developed after Marx's death, assiduously promoted by his friend Engels, who was his best PR agent.
Because I was moving towards the idea that in this social media generation, that actually you have this unfamiliar creation, which is a kind of global mob that can't be bought off the way, mobs in the Paris Revolution and the French Revolution were bought off. And that maybe that we're entering a kind of completely new kind of politics that is going to operate in a way that we still can't anticipate or predict.
I think so. Actually, I'm going to give a little advertisement for myself. This is my current interest. I'm interested in writing a global history of the second half of the 20th century. And I think that one of the things you're talking about, the globalization of mass movements, the globalization of economic structures, and the way that nation states don't quite seem to be able to deal with these, this is really a theme of the year since 1945. And I think you're onto something. And I think you're right that we're entering an era of, for a long time, it seemed that like, let's say from the 1980s onward, it seemed that like international capital and financial current seemed to like overwhelm political movements that were organized largely around nation states or confederations of nation states like the EU. But now it does seem that political movements are developing their own globalized forms. So this is just an interesting part of seeing our contemporary position historically.
It sounds like a really, really interesting thing to look forward to, and a big leap from the 19th century.
It is. But, you know, I've been studying the 19th century for four decades now, and I think, to be honest, I've run out of things to say about it. So I'd like to do something a little different.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor Jonathan Sperber.
My pleasure to talk with you, Anne.
That's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to Jonathan Sperber, whose book, Karl Marx, A 19th Century Life, is out now. You can find more of our podcasts at guardian.co.uk/audio and subscribe to Politics Weekly at soundcloud.com. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Anne Perkins. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.